All art tends to the condition of official art under the certification of the art market, which enforces a curious uniformity, as a matter of fact, on contemporary museum collections across the world. I mean, you can walk into a white room and not be able to tell from its contents whether you're in Barcelona or Los Angeles or London or Tokyo. International dealers' modernism, you know, the Pompier art of the late 20th century. I have no doubt whatever that if a museum opened in Antarctica, it would have a congealed lump of fat by Joseph Beuys and a flash-frozen Clemente and a more than usually cold David Sally and an ice block by Don Judd for the penguins to look at. And then you see there is the audience. I mean, American attitudes to art are in some ways like attitudes to wilderness. Their model was sketched early on by Fenimore Cooper in the Leatherstocking Tales. And there you have Natty Bumppo, the scout, the child of nature, musing on the still lake and the vast solitude. And somebody says to him, what do you see out there? And he replies, creation, sir, pure creation. The wilderness was assigned a moral role in your national life almost as soon as it was penetrated. It's one of the great motors of American imagination. Going west was always considered liberating, at least until you hit San Diego. And this was because wilderness in its purity was seen in the 19th century as the very fingerprint of God. And already by the 1830s, people saw that it was going. American reverence for nature has always been partly provoked by the violations of other Americans. Just as American reverence for culture quite often needed the sort of threatening bogeyman of the Philistine waiting in the wings. You know, you think of that very prescient remark by Alexis de Tocqueville, the French traveller in America, whose book written in the early 19th century is still one of the great summaries of this country. And de Tocqueville says, it is the consciousness of destruction, of quick and inevitable change that gives so peculiar a character and such a touching beauty to the solitudes of America. One sees them with a melancholy pleasure. One knows that one must be in a hurry to admire them. Hence the national parks, wilderness maintained as a metaphor of itself. And if the morally elevating power of nature lay in solitude, then, of course, everybody had a right to solitude. And what happens when solitude with nature becomes a central theme of mass culture? And half the population then flocks to the woods to be alone. Well, we lift up our eyes to the works of our Creator in order not to see the landscape of Winnebagoes that stretches before us. And only the etiquette of the gentle nature lover and the true conservative prevents us from thinking that basically we would like to nuke the other tourists. This kind of overcrowding also goes on to some degree in the art world. It raised problems for museums and critics and gallery goers and, last but not least, that natural aristocrat, the artist. The creation of a mass audience for high visual culture in America is one of those sociological events that no one could have very well predicted 25 years ago. In 1985, for instance, the number of people who visited one museum in New York, the Metropolitan, was nearly six times the total paid attendance at all matches of the National College Athletic Association. And the reason is simply education and propaganda. The educational values propagated by museums changed American curricula, and then the change in the curricula changed the fate of the museums. The trickle of cultural education in the 1950s swelled to a stream in the 60s and a flood by the 70s, and it produced a new class of cultural consumers. I mean, in the old days, people used to talk schematically about three classes of people, roughly speaking, you know, highbrows, middlebrows, lowbrows. It was the function of lowbrows, we were told, to consume Budweiser and I Love Lucy and to ride around in pickups. And the highbrows collected art and they went to difficult operas and they had a highly stratified view of culture. The equivalent, I guess, of the once popular trickle-down theory of economic subsidy, formerly beloved of our president, which was harshly summed up by Kenneth Galbraith as the presumption that if you give the horse All it can eat, the sparrow, will then find its nourishment upon the road. But the highbrow was distinguished by his omniscience, the lowbrow by his indifference, and in between there shuttled the larger army of middle brows, whose distinguishing trait was a kind of anxious uncertainty in cultural matters. But the sons and the daughters grew up in the 60s and 70s to form this, as it were, new class of cultural consumers that I speak of, the new brows. Diffused among them, one sees a tremendous interest about and a certain amount of anxiety about cultural mobility and about the nature of, you know, cultural experience. People are now expected to have opinions about opera or theatre or film as distinct from mere movies, or about painting or sculpture, as they were not expected to 25 years ago. And the growth of this class of consumers, urban, single, mobile, fairly well off, is intimately linked to college, because it's at college that most people see their first show at a museum and hear their first live symphony and for the first time purposively attend the theatre, and so on. And largely thanks to them, as we know, the culture has an absolute passion for advice. It is swarming with subsidiary gurus of every imaginable kind. I mean, it wants people to tell it how to lose weight, how to get better orgasms by carrot therapy or by rolfing or lifting dumbbells, how to get a new body, your own or somebody else's, in 90 days, or how to win at Vegas or lose your fear of the shrink, and what kind of cheese is most likely to confer social success, and how to distinguish Chateau Yquem from the humbler productions of Chateau Thunderbird, and you know, how to survive the coming nuclear holocaust and make a fortune in gold and penicillin at the same time. All you have to do is name your problem, and an advisor will appear and charge you accordingly. If no solution is in sight, then Dr. Leo Bascaglia will lurch out of the shadows and give you a big hug. All of this is related to the Constitution, which makes it more or less illegal not to pursue happiness. And much the same is true in the arts. I don't believe any culture has ever supported so many advisors. I mean, one out of three divorcees in New York City, perhaps two out of three in Los Angeles, would appear to be a corporate art advisor today. There were two galleries in Soho when I first moved there in 1970, and today there must be at least 90 if you discount with the boutique selling Erte sculptures. We have the most art schools of any society ever, and ditto museums, and ditto curators and specialists. But in the 70s, the schools, with a few exceedingly distinguished exceptions, tended not to arm their students with a full sense of their inherited language as painters. There's always a lot to unpick, in any case, when a student comes to art school. They come with ideas about relative standards which have to be gently but inexorably taken apart and then remade. And this year, some friends of mine at Cooper Union in New York ran a test on which artists the incoming first-year students had heard of. Not ones that they'd seen, just ones that they'd heard of. And, of course, 61 out of the 61 freshers naturally had heard of Picasso. He was number one. And 54 of them, as you might expect, had heard of the next two down the line, Michelangelo and Van Gogh, doubtless because they'd seen the films on the television. But then as you go lower down the list, you get some very peculiar eddies. Andy Warhol had a recognition factor of 33, whereas Donatello and Masaccio got one. Four times as many kids had heard of David Sally as knew the names of Praxiteles or of Watteau. Tintoretto scored exactly level with Keith Haring. But only half as many future artists had heard of Titian or Poussin or Velasquez or Jan van Eyck as knew the name of Jean-Michel Basquiat. Now, art teaching swelled in this country in the 60s and 70s. And today we still live somewhat in its hangover. The mass of the post-war baby boom moved through the art schools like an antelope through a python. Every university had to have its art faculty, its art department, and that department had to be full. Although there are no exact figures on the number of American art schools today, it is probably more than 1,600, with a population of something like 100,000 undergraduate and graduate students, producing maybe 35,000 graduates a year, which means that every 2 years, American schools produce as many painters, sculptors, potters, and so forth, as there were people in Florence in the last quarter of the 15th century at the height of the Renaissance. An extraordinary triumph of quantity. The training they get, again, with a number of distinguished exceptions, is often as intellectually vapid as the teaching of humanities courses, again, with distinguished exceptions, in American colleges, 75% of which, I'm told, do not require their pupils to study European history at all, while 86% of them let their humanities student graduate in peasant ignorance of ancient Greece and Rome. The impact of the equivalent for this in art schools of the traditional disciplines of such as life drawing. The impact of the 70s on American art training has yet to be fully assessed, and when it is, I doubt if the results are going to be all that reassuring. They will show a pattern very largely, but though not entirely by any means, composed of indifferent teachers doing it for survival, serving faculties which, for fear of a drop in enrollments, dislike failing anybody and were none too picky about the students' motives for being there in the first place. And there were two pieties that lay behind this softening. The first was the pseudo-therapeutic regard for the individuality of tyros, and the second, a distrust of so-called academic practices, because these were what modernism was supposed to have overthrown. Result was that, you know, high on the playpen radicalism of the day, the 1960s brought a massacre of plaster casts and a general winding down of life drawing in most, though not all, American schools. I mean, you just did your own thing, particularly in California, which gave MFAs to people for spending 3 days locked in a steel locker in the gym with a urine bottle and calling it a duration piece. And yet, it is obvious beyond dispute by now that all the great draftsmen of the modernist era, from Seurat to Picasso, from Max Beckmann to Willem de Kooning, were grounded in these formerly despised academic processes and could no more have done without them than an aircraft can do without a landing strip. And so hence the paradox, a figurative revival in the last few years, spearheaded by probably the poorest generation of draftsmen in American history. The art education system inflicted an enormous disservice upon young artists in the 70s. It said it would train them, but to a large extent it didn't. It offered, instead of rigour, a series of emollient hopes about aesthetic democracy and about therapy. It didn't invent these hopes. It didn't turn them into lies. But they were both, and they came out of the wider culture. Because one of the effects of an information-based culture, whose dominant form of social dreaming is television, is to undercut the authority of historical models by reducing the audience's attention span and sorting its art experiences out into smaller and more alienated and less structured units. As the crowd of artworks grows, every single one of them seems a little bit weaker and has less claim on the attention. And this draining of the sense of the masterpiece, which I believe to be indispensable to the growth of any sensibility, affects both the present and the past. It makes past art look kind of ghostly and value-free, so that it can be quoted and shuffled at will without deference to values it once might have embodied. And a general culture glut opens the present to a limitless eclecticism and disarms taste by making everything seem equally interesting. And so the permeability that the past acquires becomes the natural ground of hype in the present. And the market assures us in the meantime that everything old is a masterpiece and anything with gold in it is a treasure. That's the difference between masterpieces and treasures. Meanwhile, anything new is a challenge, and below this froth there lies a dispiriting scepticism, because with this size of the mass audience, there is never enough really good art to go round. And so in order to sell mediocre or bad art, the audience has to be convinced that the standards vindicated by good art are irrelevant or at any rate optional. And this so far has been part of the project of the worst side of postmodernism, and it's worked very well. Because postmodernism tried to convince us that the main purpose of classical modernism was utopian change, and that only. And since these changes manifestly failed, they didn't happen, it follows, in logic, that modernism itself failed. But it didn't. At the same time, the tendency is to take the idea of the avant-garde and vulgarize it into an idea of mere aesthetic turnover, you know, like that idea of dynamic obsolescence that was enunciated in Detroit in the 50s. You know, you bring out new lines every year, not so different from the old car that it will destroy the market value of the second-hand car, and yet, you know, sufficiently different to make it attractive and interesting to consume. Postmodernism, considered as a kind of working attitude, wants to be popular. It wants to give the mass art audience the kind of entertainment that it feels entitled to, an entertainment which is sort of, you know, vaguely learned. It likes to quote discarded styles with an air of ironical non-commitment, thus turning the past into a sort of pattern book that supplies value-free motifs. Most of the time, postmodernism is merely a rubric under which pseudo-historicist and mock virtuoso events can appear interesting for a short time. And in the midst of the hype that permeated the art world in the early 80s, but is now, thank heavens, dying off, this may not seem self-evident, but it will seem, I think, pretty clear within a couple of years. But of course, this is not true of all art being made today, not by any means. Only some upon which the art industry disproportionately depends. Nor is it true to say that because the utopian dreams of avant-gardism failed, that new art is thereby stripped of its power to influence life. It's just that it does so in a more circuitous way than our grandfathers were sometimes prepared to settle for. Because art is thought. Its structures do affect ideas. They affect the way we experience the world. They do it in a visually coded way. Real art prepares the ground for dissent. It prepares the ground for original sensation. It defends us against ideology by insisting upon what is specific and real in experience. And by taking its stand against the programmed message and the coercion of mediocrity, it offers models of consciousness that help us explain the world to ourselves. In short, it helps us distinguish between a truth and a lie. And this is never a bad function. The true frontier of art is not so much experimentation as excellence, clarity, intelligibility, articulation, fullness of form, suppleness of diction, intensity of experience, and subtlety and precision in suggesting that intensity. It's eloquence, not rhetoric. The conditions under which these can be realized vary from time to time, they vary from style to style, and they always have to be reinvented. But the first condition is a social agreement that their reinvention is both possible and desirable. And this entails being perhaps a little more severe about taste than we tend to be. It means being elitist and skeptical while keeping an open mind. And this is a balance which calls for some practice. It means not blundering around like a cow in a meadow, mistaking every thistle for a lily. It means not imagining that things are entitled to some special moral status merely because they're called art. It means forgetting the obsession with hot art, with art as investment, with art as therapy. And so it may mean, for each single person, rewriting some of the terms of official culture as it's presented to us. But I believe the effort is worth making. And thank you for listening to me with such patience tonight.
We're grateful to you for being with us to inaugurate this important series in the life of this college and community. We have been dazzled by the breadth and scope of the things you undertake to think about and analyze. You have stepped on our toes many times tonight. You've poked fingers in the ribs of our pretensions and stepped on our toes. But you have the gift of a teacher, and that is both to entertain, and then while we're entertained, then to make an important point that we will think about. We have no precedent, since this is the inaugural address, as to whether we can take a few minutes to have questions and respond to them. So I'm going to take the prerogative of saying, let's do, because it gives, I think, an audience an opportunity to see a different side of someone who has made a lecture. Because of the time, I will arbitrarily limit it to 3 questions. But I have asked Mr. Hughes if he would entertain and respond to 3 questions from the audience. And if there are those 3, he has graciously said that he would be happy to.
Well,
Father,
sure.
Questions.
On the other hand, if you don't have any, no matter. Yes, yeah. I think probably a retrospective of an artist under 40 is likely to be premature. I'm just trying to think of the. You see, generally this is this is a sort of thinly disguised form of rather heavy duty marketing. In your 30s, your business is, I think, not to be looking back upon the grand and glorious 12 years which stretch behind you. Retrospectives are something that you leave, for when you're old, for God's sake. I mean, it's like a 32-year-old putting out collected essays. It's ridiculous. But then on the other hand, let's take the other side of it. If you were to have a retrospective of, let's say, if it were possible to have a retrospective of Masaccio, it would have to be a mid-career retrospective because he died at 28. If you had a retrospective of Caravaggio, that would have to be too because he was dead at 37. But I think probably it's a bit hubristic to wind it up, before you're actually dead. Yes. Yes, sir.
Were you in London this past summer when the Harold Chapinsky exhibition was shown?
No, I wasn't. I didn't see the show. I heard about it. No, I'm afraid I've never seen any of Chapinsky's work, although a lot of people were talking about it. But I missed the show, I'm sorry to say. Yeah, a lot of people ask about Chapinsky, though. It's true. Did you see the show?
No, I've just read the account in the New York Magazine about his rediscovery,
whatever
it's called.
Yeah. Suddenly a new, I guess you'd say, second generation abstract. Yes, the Lost Abstract Expressionist. Raiders of the Lost Abstract Expressionist, yes. I'm quite prepared to believe he's a perfectly good artist, though. It is. Yes. I think it had quite a bit to do with promotion, don't you? I mean, there was an Indian gentleman who took after it with the moral fervour of an evangelist, and he really, got on Chapinsky's case. Yes.
Do you collect, if so, what, if not, why not?
Right, a good question. The answer, believe it or not, is yes or no. I think in practice, critics shouldn't collect, or at least, for the same reason as, for instance, museum curators ideally should not collect privately in the area in which they're collecting for the museum. In practice, however, nobody has blank walls. It is nice to come home at the end of a hard day in the museum and look at a nice white wall. It's restful for the eyes. But I've never collected systematically. I mean, I've got a few prints, Dürers and Rembrandts and things that I bought in London 20, 25 years ago when you could pick them up for £40 each. Ditto a few prints by living artists like Bob Motherwell. This is turning into a disclosure of assets. But still, we're in church and must tell the truth. I have a couple of paintings by English artists. I mean, I own a painting by Frank Auerbach, on whom I'm presently going to be writing a book. I own one by a man called Howard Hodgkin. And I have a painting by Lee Krasner, who I think was a terrific artist and much, much misunderstood. But she was an old friend, you know, and I bought it from her years ago. And that's just about it. I mean, I've never collected systematically because I think, you see, you know, to get to the sort of didactic core of your question, if a critic has a lot of paintings, or even one or two very expensive paintings by artists who are his contemporaries, the problem is going to be one of vested interest. It's really hard to get past this. I mean, let's say that that you've got a Tom Hess, when he was editor of when he was a friend of de Kooning and the other abstract expressionists back in the late 40s and early 50s. Amassed a very considerable collection of de Kooning's, which de Kooning had given him in the days when they were worth a couple of hundred dollars each, and they were tokens of esteem to one of the few people in America who was writing for his work and was one of his principally, you know, sort of propagandist interpreters, favourable critics. Now, that sort of classical relation between the critic and the artist was absolutely fine up to the time that suddenly the paintings began to get exceedingly valuable. I mean, if a very famous artist came along to me now and said, all right, I'm going to drop a painting on you, it's worth $150,000, you'd have to refuse it. This is the big problem. This is one of the things the market has done. It's sort of rather distorted those kind of, you know, more ethically easygoing relations between artists and critics that used to obtain. Because, you see, if you have a painting on your wall by artist A and the thing's worth 150 grand, it cannot, or more, or even less, it can't help but, you know, exercise a kind of subliminal pressure upon you. You know, you may end up not writing about it at all, writing about him at all, in which case you'll make a permanent enemy, or you write enthusiastically about him, in which case you're accused of favouritism and having taken a freebie. You know, it's a difficult one. So I think basically the sort of moral is that critics should not collect systematically, although in practice the truth is that if you want to understand a painting, there is no better way of doing it than hanging it on your wall and looking at it in privacy. I mean, this is the ideal condition of looking at a work of art to which, you know, all museums aspire. You certainly learn an awful lot about an artist, more about an artist's intentions from seeing a good example, you know, at any time of the day or night, you know, when you're looking at it and when you're not looking at it, as it were, than from making it the occasion of special scrutiny in a museum. There's no doubt about which is better, but unfortunately it's just not practical. I wish I could collect more, but I can't. I can't afford it. I can't afford the works of art I like. You know?
Thank you very much.